Thank you. I'm happy to introduce Sebastian Würde from...
From Clarion Eric, I've got many affiliations, so University of Utrecht, Nijmegen, and Frankfurt, yes.
Without further ado.
So from from Central Europe. Okay, and I will talk about languages, language, and isocodes, and I will present what we can do for cope with these systems for language diversity and variation. So first, I will say why we should do this after all. Why we need such a reference system, and what is there in the ISO standard so far, and there are some criticisms that I will address these, and I will show possible alternatives and what are their issues. And then 6 years ago, I think here was presented a general view how to cope with languages, introducing the notion of language, and I will try to address how we can formalize this in a practical and perhaps even theoretical sound away. A few words about what languages and dialects and so forth are and how we should address those. And then a plea for recognize that interlinguistic variation is multidimensional, and I will conclude. So, why do we need some reference system? Usually, we refer to languages by their names. So we talk about English and German and Arabic and so forth. But now when we come to many, many smaller languages, and this year is a conference which is interested especially in those smaller languages, we run into problem if we only use language names. Because language names can be ambiguous. There are several examples this year, only the ones with A, where you have the same language, the same name for quite different languages, actually. And also, languages, of course, have different names in different other languages. So German, for instance, my mother tongue is Deutsch, Allemand, Tedesco, Niemiecki, Tysk, and so forth, depending on in which language you come. Also, in different contexts, the same entity is referred to differently by the population in science and so forth. And then we have, of course, in our cases, many, many different spelling varieties and so forth. So language names are very, very ambiguous. Also, over time, the preferred way to address or to talk about a certain language will change. The communities are claiming that some of the names are disrespectful, and so we change how we name them, and so forth, and so forth. So that's a huge problem when we want to search for material which is out there about a certain language. Because on the one hand, it gives us low recall. So we type in one language name, and we will only get that material where this language name is used, but not all the other names which are used for the same language. And also low precision, because for one language name, we get potentially much material which actually is not about that specific language, but on something else. And some language names are even synonymous with general terms or other words, and they are even really hard to find on Google at all. They're covered, so to say. So this is why we need some standard, and in particular, systems which try to address all the languages or potentially all the languages of the world, such like the Waltz, for instance, was one of the first enterprises to address as many languages as possible. Language archives, of course, OLAC, which is this umbrella on all language archives or as many as possible, the linguist list and other entities, they need something to individually address which language is what and have one way to refer to a language. And that also holds for information technology. Unicode in particular, but also the big software companies and so forth, they all have an interest to know what entity they are referring to, and language names are not sufficient for that. You need this for identifying content on the net, so in which language is this document, which user interface I should use to present content, for spelling checkers, for input methods, so for all the keyboards which are adapted for specific languages, and all language technology which works on language material, parsers and so forth, they're usually adapted to specific languages. So these technology, they have to know with which language they are actually dealing. That means that that we need technology which is not only for the few major languages, but at this conference we saw many examples where this technology actually deals with many small languages. Industry claims, and I have been in conferences where we had representatives from Microsoft, for instance, also, who said, we don't want to be a bottleneck. We want to be open for all languages in the world and not only for the economically the significant ones. But, well, that's, of course, a broad claim. And what actually happens is sometimes different. Because what are the economically significant languages? That is a moving target, at least, right? So what is significant? We saw 2 days ago a presentation from the Rosetta Stone project where they accepted by payment to do something for a globally seen rather small language. So one of the initiatives which early on was really interested in this is Unicode, because they really want to address all languages, all writing systems for all languages, and they really needed to know which language is what. So they are really committed to this cause. So even more so, I guess the movement is really clearly that we less and less use computers and use more the small handheld devices where typing gets more and more cumbersome. And that means that our interaction with computers more and more will be orally instead of written. And that means that we will have to cope with all the variety which oral language brings with it as well. So at least for the major languages like English, English already now, the telephone answering systems, they have to know if this is a Southern accent or a Northern accent or a UK accent and so forth. So in order to properly recognize the kind of language which is spoken to them and in which way they should answer back. And that means that we will, in the near future, and actually this is already starting, we will have to cope with language varieties as well, and internal language variation as well. So that means that we need to standardize this, and people, I have heard many people saying, well, but that's just a mess and it's too complex and you have all the social factors and so forth. You can't possibly do it. But I think technology will move ahead and these things are coming, and it's better that we are in it and that we have a hand on it and that we do it scientifically sound than just letting this thing roll in any way. So standards are necessarily a compromise. So I like the example by Gary Simons, where he compares our situation with those in the time zone. So before that, the timetables for trains had enormous problems because each station had their own frame of reference, so a train could arrive earlier than it departed in the other station, and they would have many crashes, and people would lose their and miss their connections and so forth. So you need a system of only 24, or there are some more time zones on the world, which helped a lot to navigate. Everybody who doesn't live in Hawaii has felt this right now coming to this conference. So actually, perhaps even better comparison would be the situation in biology, where we have the concept of species, which is debated for very good reasons. But so there is an alternative proposal to work with clades. So whenever there is a common ancestor to many, many individuals, then you can give this a name and broader names and so forth, which corresponds to linguistic families, but also inner linguistic dialects and so forth. You can use similar systems. But for just naming, okay, this here is a description of the behavior of that and that animal, of this and this plant and so forth, an easy frame of reference is needed. And the old Linnean system is still the used system, despite the others being more sound theoretically. They don't fly in practice, and perhaps unfortunately, but that is how standards why standards are needed and how they work. So in our realm, we do have the ISO 639 family of standards, which is taken care of by the Technical Committee 37 in Subcommittee 2 in Working Group 1, which is about language quality. You see, ISO is a huge organization which deals with almost everything which could be possibly standardized in the world. So this here is the linguistic or language technology part, and this Working Group 1 is about language coding. And I'm giving this talk not last because I'm, I guess, the only linguist who is interested in linguistic diversity and has a field work background who is part of this working group in ISO. So this started in 1976 when they released what is now part one of the standard with a two-letter code, so EN for English and so forth. There are some 200 entries now, and this is more or less frozen. So it's very hard to get a new language in. You have to argue that it is really a major language with a huge body of literature and so forth to get the two-letter code. We have then concurrent systems, one used by libraries and another which came in later, which I'll show you right now. So that is the part two, which some 400 languages, major languages, and some codes for collective groups like other Oceanic language, for instance, also. And from 2000 on, ISO recognized the importance of covering really all languages when the World Wide Web came up, and they tried to serve a broader community and covering all languages. So to that time, the Ethnologue was identified as the best and most comprehensive list of languages in the world. And so they made an agreement with the some institutes of linguistics, or now SIL International, to develop and maintain the part three of the standard based on the Ethnologue. And so the Ethnologue was adjusted to the existing ISO standards, and all others were added. So some 600 changes were needed to do that. And then in 2007, for the first time, part three was published and is since then being developed. And this is going in parallel with Ethnologue. So whenever ISO changes, Ethnologue will change as well. So there are yearly updates. And now we have a more explicit procedure. In the first years, that was done very much on who shouted the loudest, got the new code, and others didn't, and so forth. And now there's a review system, and so forth. So now we have some almost 8,000 code elements, and that is in sync with the Ethnologue. And it covers all living, well, potentially all living, and many of the recently, so the last 50 years or so, extinct individual languages. There was an attempt to have more parts here. So part four will describe principles and so forth. It's a text part. And part five was in the first attempt to have three-letter codes for language, that exists for language groups like linguistic families and so forth. And there was a first attempt of also having codes for varieties of languages. And that first attempt was just a huge mess and deemed not appropriate. And fortunately, some of my colleagues and myself could convince ISO to not adopt this first attempt. So what we now need is a framework to cope with linguistic variation in the realm of ISO. So what parts one and two are very much used. Probably they are the most used ISO standard at all, because all the devices where you can change the language in your settings will make use of an ISO code, and that is many more devices than there are human beings. So it's really a very widely applied code. Part three is now more and more replacing part two, also in the industry. And there are some additional or complementary standards, like the World Wide Web standard, the Internet Task Force standard, best practice document 47, which introduces how to use these codes together with other additional information so that you also can cope with linguistic variation. So we see that some of these parts are very hardly used, and others are very broadly used. So there are many problems with ISO. So some of them have been uttered at this very conference a few years ago. So one is that it is being authoritative, so that this is the truth which is brought upon us, and we can't do much about it. Well, partly that's a straw man, and at least it's not ISO's fault, because everybody can interact with the system and make suggestion. And whatever standard there is, it would be misused by, for instance, governments and so forth. So whatever you do in this realm, you can't really escape that. The connection with Ethnologue, and that SIL is a missionary organization, and that is still the registration authority, that is indeed for many people a problem, and I believe justly so, seen as a problem. But currently I don't see any other organization which has the stamina and the financial sustainability and so forth, who could substitute SIL in being the registration authority. It is a quite expensive enterprise with having the review process and taking care of the whole system and so forth. So another problem with ISO is that the codes look very much like abbreviations of languages, and sometimes these abbreviations refer to disrespective names and so forth, and that is indeed a huge problem. We had in particular the case of Mapuche, or the Araucan language of Chile, where the local population refused to have a Wikipedia in the language because Wikipedia requires you to use the official ISO code and nothing else, and that refers to a name which they don't accept. So it's true, but I don't see really an easy solution for that, because many of the possible three-letter combinations are already taken, so you can't change many of them. And then, so right now, when you get a new code, some match or some abbreviation or so is not feasible anymore anyway. And especially ISO cannot really go into being an institution which knows who has the right to claim what is the correct name and what should be used or not be used as an abbreviation and so forth. You get into political and social and so forth matters which are above the what ISO can do. And we can't also just replace it with a new system which only uses, for instance, numbers and so forth. Industry won't change at this point anymore. We have those three-letter codes and that won't change anymore. So we have to think about these like something like a system of three-digit base 26 numbers where every letter represents a number, and that connection is historically true for in many cases, but in the future not, and we should as good as we can forget about this direct connection. The genealogical classification is questionable, is often said. Well, that is true for ethnologue, but ISO doesn't make any claims on relatedness of languages and so forth. That's really just a list of code, language, and nothing else. Then, of course, that there are problems in delineating what is a language, what is a dialect, and especially in dialect chains we have these problems. That is a problem which exists in general and is not an ISO problem. So also, what do we define as a language? Is it more social or more functional, or structural entity and so forth? So I think there are pragmatic solutions which are feasible, and I'm running out of time, but I will try to address them a little bit. So there are other problems, that the transparency is low. We really don't know who are the reviewers. Some of us are specialists in a certain area and never have been asked by Ethnolog, ISO, SIL, and so there are still doubts, but the process has improved quite a lot in comparison how it started. So what we need would be a scientific advisory board, and we would actually need volunteers from here, and that is something where I hope that some of the people who would be able to do this are actually in this room. Okay, indeed. I'm running out of time, so I will go rather quickly through that. Of course, there are some online sources like the UNESCO Atlas, the Multitree, the LCAT here in Hawaii based, and the Linguasphere Register, which was the basis for the Part 6 and ISO and so forth. They all are useful for part of it. Some of them don't address all languages, but only endangered languages, and all of them face the sustainability problem. So it's all project-based, there is no sustainable funding, and we don't know how these systems will be maintained over the next 5 or let alone 10 or 20 years. One of the most promising alternatives for linguists is the glottolog, and for instance Wikipedia usually now lists the three-letter codes together with the glottolog code, and I guess that is indeed the best system that we have. But it is not good for dialects and for language internal variation, and they claim and they don't claim that even. So, but also there, the sustainability problem with the Leipzig Institute having ended to maintain it officially is really a problem. And so, in many cases, there's only one hierarchy of inner language variation. So, for the reasons of time, I will skip this part on language and so forth, which I wanted to argue what these entities actually are. I have given a similar version of this talk in 20 minutes before, so I don't know why why I'm right now running out of time this time, but that's the way it is. So I make a proposal, and I hope I will get this out in written form soon, where I address what languages and these kind of entities actually are. And I think what we need is a more sophisticated system than what we have so far, which only have linguistic families, individual languages, and dialects. That's the tree that we by now know. But there are more complex cases. But I don't think that it is so messy that we can't create a system where we have some more 5 or 6 terms which would actually address what is out there empirically. So that we can have something like language complexes and language areas and emergent languages and so forth. If we create some more theoretical sound terms, I think we can address what we have on this kind of borderline cases and so forth, which are not covered by the families, language, dialects, terminology. And especially, and that is my last plea here, I think we need to recognize that language internal variation is multidimensional, and that means we not only have dialects, which is linguistic variation in space, but we of course have also linguistic variation in time and linguistic variation by social groups, so the social acts in a broader sense, also linguistic variation by the medium, so oral, written, but we also have other modalities of language. The situation, the different formality, so formal registers and informal registers and so forth. And we have individual variation. Everybody speaks a little bit different from their neighbor. And perhaps we need to recognize, at least for pragmatic reasons, one or more dimensions. But what my plea is to recognize that, of course, they interconnect and not all social acts exist in all dialects and so forth. But they are different dimensions. So we have to address the specific utterance or the specific resource or text or what we have in all of these dimensions. And then we get a realistic description of what a certain linguistic entity is. And we need a system that copes for these different dimensions individually. And so far, they have always been blended into one hierarchy, and that always gives a mess. So dialects only for oral, but that's not true. They also appear in written language and so forth and so forth. So they are independent dimensions. So, summing up, I think we need a pragmatic system. There's no way around the ISO standard for 3-letter codes so far. Glottolog could supplement this, but we need to put a lot of work in it and solve the sustainability question. We need an expert panel so that the review process can be more recognized and scientifically sound. We need to recognize that we need some more terms, but those family language dialects are not useless just because they don't apply in all the situations. They apply in many, in most situations. And we need a framework for what are languages and language and so forth. And we have to recognize that language internal variation is multidimensional. So a little bit over time, but thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. We have about 7 minutes for questions, and I will use my role as a volunteer moderator to start off with a couple of which is, one is I think you've swept the issue of the Mapuche type problem under the rug, and I think that's a real problem, so I'm wondering how we might actually address that. And the other regards the Scientific Advisory Board. Would this be a advisory to the Registration Authority or to ISO?
Both are very, very good questions. So when the questions with the Mapuche case came up, I was actually arguing, being a South Americanist, and that is the largest autochthonous language where this problem occurred in South America. I was arguing for having a change this one time because this is really so important for that community. But I couldn't convince my colleagues that time because they said, and I think there is a point there, if we start this in this case, we don't know where the border is. So there might be this very small group of 200 people where there are two factions, and one say our language is called this, and the other faction says our language is called that, and we want this code, we want that code, we won't have it. And who decides? So who are we to decide who is right and who is wrong in this kind of situation? So I will continue to argue in this case, but it is really a tough thing. And ISO says we once have fixed a code and it started to be used, and we should only change it if there is really something which is where situation is where we have a no-go. I think we have this, and I have still to convince my colleagues of that. But I see the I see the argument that it is really hard to argue. So where do we get into if we start to do this kind of changes?
If you're going to make a code, you have made that decision, right? So
yeah.
No decision is a decision. So
exactly.
It is
a bad decision in this case. Yes,
yeah.
Of course. They should have heard the community earlier, but there are many cases like this. And the scientific advisory board would be an advisory board to ISO, but of course the institution with which it would interact is the registration authority. So there's no way to go around. This isn't the hand of SIL International, and they will be the brokers of such requests.
So one of the problems I've heard that's encountered in things like giving codes up. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, but I didn't get your word. So
one of the problems I've encountered in classifying my
encountering. Sorry,
encountered.
Yeah, I encountered.
Sorry, am I speaking too quickly?
No, sorry. I guess
is spurious languages and relying on language surveys for doing things like that, or especially in South America, if I'm not mistaken, there's a number of cases where either we're not entirely sure that this language exists, or
yeah.
It's given some. It's called one thing by one person and one thing by another, and there's no contact with the actual people themselves.
Yeah.
To rectify the situation.
There are many cases like that. And there has been, there's our colleague Harald Hammerstrom, and I think he is the one person in the world who really knows where languages exist and where they don't exist, because he's getting all the literature on all languages, and he speaks with the local experts, and he's really the spider in the center of the net. And he has a very good review written of Ethnologue, of two editions of Ethnologue, and I finally convinced my colleagues from SIL International to have a look at this review and to cope with those issues addressed there without somebody making a formal request, because right now you have to hand in a request, and Harald says rightly, I won't do this for 560 cases where identified that this year is wrong. Those two terms are the same language, and this language actually doesn't exist, and this year is just a dialect, and so forth and so forth. So they are looking at this, but as you can, I think there are some 500 cases where he identified mismatches in non-existing languages or two codes for the same thing and so forth and so forth. And they are trying to clean it up and to speak with the actual linguists. And then, of course, there are many other cases where you can question, does this really need a code, or what is it actually? And then we get into the problem of addressing interlinguistic variation. There, on your side.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question about the time dimension. I'm working with language maintenance and revitalization in two areas, Northern Australia and Scandinavia, where I come from. And for example, Älvdalia, if you're familiar with that in central Sweden, it's very archaic Scandinavian. And some people try to continue to use case,
mm-hmm.
and some people now don't. To help, to be meaningful in that situation, you would need one code for Älvdalian 1900 and one for 2000.
Yeah.
Are you aiming for that? We would also need the same thing, for example, Google Imagery in Northern Australia, where I work.
Yeah.
Do you think that would happen?
No, not on the level of languages. So I don't think that we would have a part three letter ISO code for these different types, where you still have case and where you lose it, for instance, in the case of Dolian. But in the system that we need to address interlinguistic variation, we would certainly have those different varieties being recognized on the temporal dimension, and then having a good coding system for them. Some of them might be used synchronically right now. So there might be speakers who use case right now and others who don't. So you have two inner varieties of that linguistic entity. And I guess Dolian has a three-letter code. If I've looked into that a couple of years ago, It was already cited as an interesting case to me once. So
yes.
we need now to address the inner linguistic variation in a sound way, but we can't create three letter codes for anything where something is structurally, for instance, different and recognizable different, because we have this with dialects and with sociolects all over the place. So no three letter codes, but in the part for inner linguistic variation, the recognition of different varieties, which you then can label correctly. That would be the answer.
Take maybe one more short question.
Yes, but exactly a follow up on that. Where to put the boundary, the limit? Because you could, in principle, have a, I don't know, 100 letter codes for every idiolect. What do you want to?
Exactly. So
you have to put the via boundary, and it is another problem with this Mapuche stuff, but slightly similar. I was working with Mankieli, the Finnish language in Tornada. They have the code fit, which is, if you know Swedish, fita is not quite a nice word, but they have to cope with that.
Yes.
They have to cope with that. This is a similar problem as with Mapuche.
Yeah.
So because it's kind of negatively, or I don't know.
Exactly. No, I'm aware of many of such situations. Wherever I present about this, there will be some people around to say, well, I know this case where you really can't, and so forth. I know, and I will argue against it. And the inner linguistic variation, yes, you have to cope with this, and even on the individual level. So name the author of a certain piece of utterance, and you will have the individual dimension of linguistic variation, and you have to cope with it, indeed. Yes.
Okay, so I think we should wrap it up there, and thank our speaker, and our next talk will happen here.